by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you see it coming, no time to beg out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass makes heaven the middle of it. Grass makes heaven the middle. We are grass makes heaven.
Secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. We've got a really fine guest this evening, Lance DeHaven Smith. And let me tell you just a little bit about him, and I'll let him expand on it a little bit. He's a professor at Florida State University in the Reuben O. D. Askew School of Public Administration and Policy. He's a former president of the Florida Political Science Association. He's the author, co-author, or editor of about 15 books. And we're going to explore somewhat one of those books tonight. It's called Conspiracy Theory in America. Welcome to our program, Lance DeHaven Smith. I'll tell you what, you really got a good winner in this. We brought you in on this because we've got a lot of things brewing out there, I guess, in the old cauldron. You know what I mean? From the witch's cauldron, I guess is what I meant to say. But, yeah, these people, they practice a lot of different occult, you know what I mean, sciences on us. Tell us, our listening audience, a little bit more about your background and so forth. I did a quick introduction there.
I have a PhD in political science from Ohio State University. I wrote my last book, the recent book, was on conspiracy theory. But the book before that came out in 2005 from the University of Florida Press was on the 2000 election. And Florida State University is in Tallahassee, the capital of Florida, and I studied Florida government and politics. I knew the law when the election recount was occurring, and I saw all kinds of crimes being committed by both sides, and there was clearly a conspiracy by the people who were supposed to administer the law to block a legally mandated recount, and there was just a lot of intrigue, and I thought it would be investigated after the election. I didn't expect anybody to be able to stop this stuff when it was happening because it was so chaotic and there were timetables to finish the election and so on, but I thought that it would be investigated and people would be held accountable for it, and then nothing happened. And in fact, people just said, get over it and move on. And so I studied it carefully and wrote a book about it and listed the crimes, some of the crimes that were committed. And but nothing ever happened after that. And I started studying what I call elite political criminality. The American founders called these high crimes. These are crimes committed in high office by political insiders. And we have a long tradition of studying these and being concerned about them in America, but after World War II, it became a bad thing to raise suspicions about government, and in part there was a lot of government secrecy started at that time. Anyway, I was studying this, and I did a simple thing. I wrote a list of all the things since World War II, the election problems, the assassinations, the defense failures, the misrepresented intelligence, the orchestrated attacks and defense failures, and it really shocked me. I mean, I had grown up in the 1950s and 60s. I was born in 1951, and I remember the Kennedy assassination, and I had been, you know, alive during all this, but it never dawned on me, you know, how frequently these kinds of suspicious events have occurred and how they've gone unexamined and we know they happen, we're very suspicious of them, but we can't get answers, good answers. So I wrote this list, and I mean, one of the things that stood out was, gee, we've had a lot of assassinations where we had a spree of them, an assassination spree, with John Kennedy in 1964, Malcolm X in 1965, Martin Luther King in 1968, and a month later, Robert Kennedy, George Washington.
Well, must I correct you a second? JFK was 63. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't want to let that pass, so listening audience. Yeah, 63. And it's going to be 50 years this 22nd of this month.
There's a whole string of assassinations. And some of them occur together, so you get John Kennedy in 63. And, you know, they arrest this Lee Harvey Oswald, and they interrogate him for 2 days, and nobody takes notes. And nobody records the conversation, the interrogation. And then the guy is shot and killed in police headquarters while in police custody. I mean, it's just incredible. And but you have this whole series of these, with Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, and Robert Kennedy and George Wallace, and then Reagan is shot in 1980. But then we have the same other things. 1968, we find out that Richard Nixon undermined the peace talks between Vietnam, North Vietnam, and South Vietnam, because he was afraid if they made peace, the Democrats would win the presidential election. I mean, that was treason, what Nixon did. And in fact, we found out in 1997 when a tape was released, an audio tape of Lyndon Johnson talking to Edward Dirksen, the Republican leader in the Senate. And Johnson says, you know, we've found out Nixon is doing this and it's treason, but I'm not going to tell the American people because it would undermine their confidence in the United States government. So you, Everett, you need to talk to Nixon and get him to quit this stuff. This is treason. This comes out in 1997. It's in the news one day and it's gone. You know, nobody pays any attention to it. But it's what effectively happened is, I mean, as many people died in Vietnam, soldiers, after the 1968 election as died before it. So we had all these deaths for really no reason. We ended up with the same agreement, but Nixon had undermined this process. I refer to this as the 1968 October surprise. Of course, we had a 1980 October surprise when George H.W. Bush and others, Bill Casey, who was the campaign manager for the Reagan-Bush campaign in 1980, they met with the Iranian leaders to convince them to keep the hostages who had been taken about a year before, and made Carter look really bad. They talked the Iranians into keeping them hostage, and it really made it impossible for Carter to get reelected. I don't know what you think about Carter or Reagan or whatever, but this again is a treasonous thing to do. It's aiding and supporting and working with the enemies of our nation. So anyway, I did this long list, and you know, there was the October surprises, there were defense failures and provocations. There's pretty good reason to think that Franklin Roosevelt knew Pearl Harbor was coming. I knew when it was, that it was going to be December 7th, that it was at Pearl Harbor, and that he deliberately prevented the military commanders at Pearl Harbor from being warned. They had asked for a couple of years had complained up through the chain of command that they had inadequate resources to defend Pearl Harbor. But these guys get relieved of duty and court-martialed. They demanded.
Yeah, they tried to court-martial them after Pearl Harbor attack. these people have no qualms or morals or anything, do they?
It means nothing. And people, and this is
it
what
means
people
nothing.
Say.
Yeah.
If you tell them they should be suspicious of 9/11 or the anthrax letter attacks or something like that, people say, well, American leaders wouldn't do that. And then they say if they tried to do it, they couldn't get away with it. And if they did pull it off, somebody would talk. There's this notion that these kinds of crimes are impossible to pull off in our society. What I tell people is, well, wait a minute, what about the nuclear bomb, the Manhattan Project? This was a secret. It involved 100,000 people working on that project. Truman, who became president after Franklin Delano Roosevelt died, did not know about the atomic bomb until he had been president for a week. He was not told. They finally tell him, and he's got to make this decision on whether to use it. But the important point is that these people keep secrets quite well. to think that they can't pull these things
right.
off is really naive to the extreme.
Do you think that there's been a mind boggle, a trauma-based type of programming dynamic on this 9/11 truth, where they're hard to press to realize it, or they refuse to admit it to themselves, the average American?
What I explain in my book is that after the Warren Commission report came out in August of 1964, people were immediately suspicious. I mean, the thing about killing Lee Harvey Oswald, it just something looked wrong. It's just too suspicious. And people started writing books and raising questions. And if you look at the Warren Commission report, it is obvious, just in the report, that there had to be more than one shooter because the trajectory of the bullet that hits Kennedy in the back and neck. There's a bullet wound in his back and his neck. There's supposedly one shot. And the bullet wound in the exit wound, supposedly, is higher. It's right under his Adam's apple.
That magic bullet theory.
The hole in the back would have to be above the hole in the front. It's not. So in the report, it's really there. So people start raising questions. Well, the CIA launched a global propaganda campaign in 1967 to popularize the term conspiracy theory and conspiracy theorist, and to label anybody who's complained about the Warren Commission as a conspiracy theorist, and said that they were paranoid, they were under the influence of communist propagandists. They were in love with their own theories. They were trying to make money. They were trying to gain notoriety. But they contacted all of their, what they call their media assets. This is in a CIA memo that was sent to all the offices around the country of the CIA, around the world. And it was declassified in 1976 by mistake, but we got it. And you can find it online. It's called Dispatch 1035-960, and I read it.
Yeah, we'll put that up on our site. We haven't done it yet, but that'd be a good link to put up on your program
what
here.
What you see is these guys. I mean, these are people that we're the American people. We're supposed to be the sovereign of this country. We're the king, so to speak, and they're going to mislead us and abuse us for raising questions about the elites. So they launched this campaign. So they've clearly got this effort going on since the 1960s to confuse us and to keep us from being suspicious and to keep us from raising questions and to marginalize and silence anyone who does. The 9/11 thing, when you look at it, it is, I think, a psychological warfare operation. One of the key things that people don't talk about, but if you look at the date, it was on September the 11th, 9/11. And that number is directly related to the emergency phone number for emergencies in the United States, 911. And we call it 9/11. It was called that in a story in the New York Times the day after the event. But it's the first time, aside from July the 4th, which is Independence Day, but we call it sometimes July the 4th, that there's never been an event like this in American history where we use the date to name it. I mean, Pearl Harbor, for example, it happened on December 7th. And we don't call that 12/7. And even though Roosevelt said this is a day of infamy and, you know, tried to make it a day, we call it Pearl Harbor. And events like that, we typically name for the place it occurs or the type of weapon used, Oklahoma City bombing, Kennedy assassination. Yeah.
Or the Waco, you know, the Branch Davidian attack, or like the Oklahoma bombing. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Seems to me naturally called 9/11 would have been the hijacked airplane attacks or the day of terror or something like that. So when you see it with a date and there's something by calling it 9/11, we're really raising kind of the historic importance of it. We're saying there was before this date, there was the way the world was, and then 9/11, September 11th happens and everything changes. And that's what they said. And then you see these people roll out a language of this really came out of World War II and the concept of emergencies. So you get people like Condoleezza Rice and George W. Bush saying, we did not want the, you know, when they were talking about Iraq, they say, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud. Now, this is a powerful idea.
Well, isn't that what LBJ used to help defeat Barry Goldwater with this mushroom cloud behind a little girl or something with a flower? Yeah.
And Daisy and a nuclear bomb going off that.
Yeah.
A very powerful psychological image.
So he was able to portray Goldwater as a warmonger or a pro-war. Yeah.
And these guys, when 9/11 happened,
right,
you know, they start talking about Ground Zero. This is a nuclear image. They use the term mushroom cloud and homeland defense and, you know, this language that comes out of World War II. And, you know, I defy anyone to believe that George W. Bush can invent language like that. I mean, you know, he was not known as the sharpest tack in the box. But even if he was, it takes experts to come up. I mean, that phrase, we don't want the smoking gun to be a mushroom cloud, that had to be, you know, a public relations person.
Right. Oh, that was a clever writer that on his staff, that's for sure.
Used and the language changed so quickly, and they clean up the site really fast. Another thing about 9/11 is the anthrax letter attacks occurred within a week. They were mailed after that. And we know the anthrax was it was a strain produced by the United States Army. There's no doubt about that. And what we should be saying is, well, if that was U.S. Army, it was an inside job of some sort, and maybe 9/11 was too. But, you know, they got this guy committed suicide, and they blamed him. So it's very hard also for Americans to accept. I mean, these events are traumatic on a huge scale, watching those buildings fall. You remember the people jumping out?
Yes. Well, they keep replaying that with the video, so it reprograms people. And what I see is that it hurt people at a real deep psyche state. So there's a lot of hate and resentment against these people that did this to America. And they're just taking people around and manipulating them through that hate and so forth.
You know, it was very sophisticated, 9/11, but we've done the same thing. We've gotten better at it, you know, over the years. So you got Pearl Harbor, you've got the Gulf of Tonkin event that leads to the Vietnam War. We had boats in the Gulf of Tonkin in international waters, and we would race up to the shores of the islands of North Vietnam off of the Tonkin Gulf and bomb them, and then race back to international waters. And the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, came out and chased us back into international waters. And they had fired on us one day, and then 2 days later they didn't fire on us, but we claimed they did. And Johnson and McNamara went to Congress and said we had been attacked. And this is a month before the election, before the 1964 election. Remember Goldwater?
Right.
Goldwater was saying that Johnson was not tough enough. Johnson, his claim was, Goldwater says, we're at war in Vietnam, and Johnson is acting like we're not. He's soft on this, and we're going to lose over there. So the Gulf of Tonkin gets cooked up as an event to where Johnson can launch a war and claim to be, you know, tough on communism and a strong American leader right before the election. And this again is pretty typical. If you look at the Iraq War, which was a bogus pretext for war, that occurred, the resolution by Congress authorizing George W. Bush to invade Iraq was passed in September of 2002 in the run-up to the 2002 election. It wasn't a presidential election, but it was a congressional election. And these guys, these congressmen, everybody in the House is running every 2 years. So these guys are all facing election. And you come along and tell them they've got a vote on whether we're going to invade Iraq. I mean, they're not going to back down. They're going to be afraid to speak against that. So this kind of manipulation of the war events is quite common. And in fact, if you go back, I told you I did that list of assassinations and defense failures and election problems and so on. And what you see is there's a great many of them that foment war or escalate war or keep us at war. And so what it suggests is there are interests in the government who favor war, who benefit from war, who for one reason or another ideologically think war is a good thing for America to do. And they manipulate events to keep us with a belligerent foreign policy. And what 9/11 did was it really launched a global war of aggression by the United States all over the world. Not on a huge scale, not like Vietnam, although Iraq and Afghanistan are clearly like that. But we have, 500 and something bases around the world. And now we started killing people with these drones. And these are basically police actions. You know, we haven't declared war on somebody and then have gone and killed these people. We've just done it unilaterally without a declaration of war, without any approval from the United Nations. Now people say, well, the United Nations, should we do what they say? Well, that's a treaty. We signed that treaty after World War II, and our Constitution says treaties are the highest law of the land. So if we ignore the United Nations and don't go and work through international law to deal with our enemies and adversaries and rivals, we are violating our Constitution. And really, I think we have been outside of our Constitution for decades. We don't declare war anymore. The other thing about the war declaration, it's not just that we don't declare war. We delegate to the president the decision to go to war. When the Iraq resolution was passed, it didn't say, we are going to go attack Iraq. Same with the Gulf of Tonkin. It did not say, we are going to go attack Vietnam. What it said was the president can decide whether to attack these countries. Now, that's an unlawful delegation of congressional authority. It's war-making authority to the president. And it's clearly unconstitutional on the face of it. But it's a fairly standard thing now. But so when we look now to see, we've got this dragnet surveillance where they're sweeping up all of our phone records and who knows what, and we're shocked by it. But the reality is, we've got a government that's pretty much outside the rule of law, and has been for a long time. And when we raise questions about it, or people get suspicious, or they don't want to go to war, I think there are people in our government who are willing and quite capable of manipulating events to get us to support aggression. Yeah, another thing about the aggression is we need to remember that after World War II, we tried the Nazis for a conspiracy. It was a conspiracy charge. The first charge in the indictment was that the Nazis, through the Reichstag fire and other events, had taken over a legitimate democratic system and had, through scaring the people, created support for authoritarian rule and invading other countries, what came to be called aggressive war or war of aggression. Well, we charge these people with conspiring to do this and with the genocide and the other horrors, and we tried them, and we convicted them, and we hung by them. So we as a nation have said that these kinds of conspiracies are the worst of all crimes, the worst war crime that you can have. And yet it looks quite like we are doing the same thing. Another thing that I would remind people, it's a good thing to go back and look at the Nuremberg War Crimes Trials. A couple of things. One is we tried the journalist who turned a blind eye to what Hitler was doing, and who spouted anti-Semitism and urged a war. We tried them and hung them. I mean, so in our country, I think journalists, they have a constitutionally protected profession, the press. It's the only constitutionally protected profession in our country. And these people, we as journalists, have a responsibility to be accurate and probe and be diligent and vigilant and truthful. And I don't think our journalists are doing that. I think our best or our people at the top are lackeys for the political elite and get access by not raising questions. There's a handful of top journalists who speak out and do some things. And you've got guys like Glenn Greenwald, who's working with like Edward Snowden. But generally speaking, the journalists really foment war and are cheerleaders for the people who are effectively attacking the American public. So I would, I think what we need to do is get back to the rule of law, but I mean rule of law where you arrest people and prosecute them and punish them. We've had a few people investigated, a few top leaders. Nixon, for example, resigned. But what people don't remember is when Nixon resigned, he was pardoned. And when he was pardoned, he was pardoned not just for crimes he committed, but for any crimes he might have committed. Read the pardon. It's in my book. You can get it online. The pardon said any crimes he might have committed since taking office in January of 1969. So here we pardon this guy without ever getting clear and investigating what he did and you know, clarifying the historical record. I mean, people nowadays, when he died, people spoke well of him. You know, he had gone to China, blah, blah, blah. But this guy was a traitor. I mean, he had cost us tens of thousands of lives in Vietnam so he could get elected in 68. He had undermined our election process in 1972. The men who were involved in Watergate, two of them, G. Gordon Liddy and E. Howard Hunt, worked in the White House and had been instructed to kill Jack Anderson. And Jack Anderson was a great investigative reporter, and he, you know, released a lot of information about the Vietnam War and how our leaders had misled us into that war. You know, they were being told in 1964 when we got into Vietnam, the CIA had said, well, it'll take 500,000 soldiers for us to just break even in Vietnam. We will not win the war. We might be able to hold off the North. And what they told us was, hey, it's just a bunch of guerrillas. It'll be no problem. And, of course, we got 500,000 men in there, and we didn't win. And if people had been told that on the front end, they would not have gone. Well, Jack Anderson was exposing this stuff. And Charles Colson is sort of the Karl Rove of the Nixon administration. He's the political advisor inside. Instructed Hunt and Liddy to prepare a plan to kill Anderson, and they did prepare it, and it was called off. They were also planning to kill Ted Kennedy. It looks like they could have had a hand in the attack on George Wallace. If not, the Watergate people, somebody in our government. Wallace actually went to the FBI and told them that it had to be Nixon, he was a threat to Nixon, Wallace was, because he had carried five southern states in 1968, and it looked like he would carry seven states in 1972, and if it was a close election, that would cost Nixon the election. It's like when George H.W. Bush ran against Clinton, he had Ross Perot running as a third party. Perot didn't, you know, got 20% of the vote, and it cost a bunch of states to pop Bush, and Clinton won without a majority of the electorate. But so Nixon really feared it, and Wallace went and said, you know, I think Nixon had me shot, and the guy who shot me had an expensive gun and was staying at expensive hotels and knew my schedule. And, you know, how does some, you know, person come get the money and the resources to do that? And what's interesting is Wallace never spoke publicly about this. And this is another thing about our political class, our leaders. They're scared of each other. They're very afraid of each other. The Kennedy family never spoke about John Kennedy and the Warren Commission, even though we know now from interviews of their family, that they thought it was a right-wing conspiracy that killed them. But nobody ever spoke out and said this. Robert Kennedy was the Attorney General. He should have, you know, by all rights, you'd think, well, he would have investigated this, but he wasn't. He just had to figure they would kill him and kill his family, kill his kids. And he was going to reinvestigate the Kennedy assassination after he expected to be elected president in 1968, but of course he was killed. Another thing I would urge Americans to look at, these, you know, it sounds like this is all complicated and there's all this intrigue and stuff. But actually, it's pretty obvious. I mean, that's part of why they have to have a traumatic event and special words and all kinds of propaganda to get us to not see what is obvious. John Kennedy gets killed, and the guy who shoots him is murdered in police headquarters. I mean, that's obvious. I mean, you don't have to be a genius to figure out.
Right. They had to cut off the investigation, so they killed Lee Harvey Oswald.
They must have been silencing him. They must have been. You know, that's what it looked like. It was automatic. People would react to it.
Yeah.
And when any normal crime occurs, if some man marries a wealthy woman, and she slips in the tub and dies, and he inherits a bunch of money, we automatically are suspicious because it's an improbable event, and he benefits. If he marries again, and the woman who's wealthy dies in some kind of freak accident, then we're totally suspicious. We're infuriated. We want the bodies dug up, you know. But when we have our own government, you see Kennedy killed, Oswald killed, Bobby Kennedy killed. Bobby Kennedy was killed the day he won the Democratic primary in California. I mean, it's literally like people were saying, well, you know, we need to whack this guy if he does well, but let's see if he's going to win. And if he's not going to win, we won't do anything. But if he is, we'll take him out. So he wins, and boom, he is killed that night. 9/11, you know, those buildings, these are 110-story skyscrapers that fell into their own footprint in 10 seconds. You know, I don't give a thing that anybody says that's a miracle.
Right. Well, you know, natural law, you can't change that, and then they just fell too fast not to be undermined with something under. You know what I mean? Yeah, that's right. So they just fell too quickly, and that natural law would point to some kind of energy to bring them down. We don't know exactly what it was yet, do we?
I mean, the reason we don't know is the government does not investigate itself. It has a conflict of interest in it. And that, the solution to this is really simple. All we need to do is start applying the same forensic techniques we apply to ordinary crimes to these horrific events. The building's falling. Anybody who had a building that burned up or fell like that, the insurance companies would demand an investigation to make sure that they hadn't set the fire with arson or put explosives in the building, and there would have been a thorough investigation. But this, the government is investigating it, and it cleans up the debris, ships it to China, and then doesn't look in the debris for explosives or incendiaries. Now, But investigative arm NIST, the National Institute of Technologies and Standards, did that. It was committing a crime. The people who didn't look for those possibilities were being malfeasant in office or nonfeasant. They weren't carrying out their duties the way that they naturally should be expected to. And we should bring those people in. They are accessories after the fact. There was a crime. Many Americans' lives were lost. Somebody did this. It was more than just these Arabs flying planes and getting past the multi-layered defenses, air defenses of the United States, the most powerful country in the world. And it was bringing down these buildings and Building 7 and the strange attack on the Pentagon. And this was a very suspicious event, and the people who didn't investigate it should be the first ones we bring in, because they're the ones who concealed the crime that we might have gotten back to the original authors of that crime.
You know, you have a concept called SCAD, State Crimes Against Democracy.
Tell us how that
would fit into what's going on. These crimes that you've just described here.
This is because of the CIA and our intelligence apparatus, is naming the thing that we're suspicious of. We have this term conspiracy theory, But that doesn't name the crime. Now, if you think about crimes, we have white-collar crime, juvenile crime, hate crime. We're used to naming these crimes. And then when we have a series of crimes, we look at them. You know, we see the bankers all make a bunch of money in the bank. And the people go broke and everything. And we go and look at it. It's white-collar crime. We have a white-collar crime unit in the FBI, a large unit, that investigates these crimes. But we don't have a name for assassinations and defense failures and election breakdowns and things like that in which the elites benefit are at least partly responsible for have prevented resisting and are responsible for investigating. And we see these things happen and we're like, man, that is something's clearly wrong there. And then we get these, you know, whitewash cover-up reports like the Warren Commission or the 9/11 Commission or the FBI investigation of the anthrax letter attack. And we're left, you know, scratching our heads and knowing something's wrong, knowing we didn't get a right account of this. But when people say conspiracy theory, what they're doing in part is trying to force you to come up with a complete theory. It's like, if Oswald didn't do it, then who did? And tell us how many people there were and all that. Well, wait a minute.
Yes.
That's not our job to solve these problems. That's the government's job. And those sons of guns have not given us a reasonable account. But we need to name these crimes. Now, the founders call them high crimes. It's the simple thing is people in high office committing crimes. They knew that there were conspiracies. They called them factions. They said that the biggest danger to the government was that a faction would take over the government and start wars. And basically that's what's happened in our country. But people don't use the term high crime. So I said, well, let's call it a crime against democracy, a crime against democracy committed by the government, a state crime against democracy. And so it gives us a name for these things. And we're not sitting around getting beat up about being conspiracy theorists. The people who are using the term conspiracy theory to silence and marginalize people, they are one of the biggest threats to our government and our freedom and our way of life. Our government was founded on the idea that power corrupts. We have a system of checks and balances that pits the leaders against each other. Unfortunately, they've quit working against each other. They look the other way for each other. And we have a political system largely that is a political class that views the American people as a threat. The biggest threat in our lives today is not from terrorists, it's from our own government. These people view us as a danger and a threat and not adequately supportive of their efforts to protect us. It's like we can't say for ourselves what we need to do to be protected.
Right. You know, recently there's this project underway at Cambridge called Conspiracy and Democracy, the subtitle of History, Political Theory, and the Internet. What would be your comments on that? It's just started up over there, and they had some speeches recently at a festival of ideas there at Cambridge. But they're going to go into these conspiracy theorists, and what are your thoughts and comments there?
What they're doing is saying there's some kind of psychological mindset that encourages people to believe conspiracy theories, and that there's a paranoia, and people are susceptible to these wild-haired beliefs and so on. What's so ridiculous is, obviously, there's a psychology of people who dismiss conspiracy theories. There's a psychology of people who will not condone suspicion of the government. There's a psychology of people who support war and aggression and power unchecked and unquestioned. And there's a psychology of that. question. And, but these people are saying, no, these people who are conspiracy theorists, they've got some kind of emotional problem. Well, the emotional problem is you, is the people who are doing these studies. And it's just, it's the height of hypocrisy in that they would psychologize other people's beliefs when their own beliefs cry out for a psychological interpretation. Why would they be so afraid of suspicion? Why would they be so interested in attacking it and trying to use science to make it look bad?
Right. I did a little digging on this, and the director of the Leverhulme Trust right now is Gordon Marshall, and he was formerly associated with the Economic and Social Research Council. And what that council has recently funded is a $96 million project on what they call big data. And this tells you exactly where they're coming from. I believe that the goal for this new project on conspiracies is to go after 9/11 truth and try to destroy that idea totally and the people that support it.
Anniversary of Kennedy, and you see that they've rolled out
a
series of books. But you got to wonder if they weren't. I mean, there's several books like Jonathan Kay, Among the Truthers, that attack the 9/11 truth movement. And it comes out on, like, the 10th anniversary of 9/11. And you're seeing the same kind of thing with the Kennedy assassination, people sort of preemptively saying that the Warren Commission was right or whatever, which is a ludicrous thing to claim.
It is ludicrous. 2 weeks ago here in Austin, we had a Texas Book Festival, and they had two members on this panel say that very thing about it was a single a bullet, you know, theory, the magic bullet and all that. They're still writing books about it, you know,
but
about the lie, the big lie.
In Dallas is, you know, there's historically a group that meets every year on November 22nd to honor and remember the assassination and the call for a more investigation. Well, this year, with the 50th anniversary, the city would not give a permit to that group to meet at Dealey Plaza. I think of this, I would joke among my colleagues that what's going on is they've got to keep the Kennedy assassination under wraps. They've got to prevent people from recognizing that was a conspiracy, because once people see that, the next thing they'll say is, well, so was Martin Luther King and Bobby Kennedy. It's like telling a child there's no Santa Claus. The child immediately says, oh, don't tell me the tooth fairy is not real either, and the Easter bunny, you know, so you get this kind of babbling.
Right. Well, you know, there's Lance, there's that Coalition on Political Assassinations, and that other group, they're going to have conferences up there. And the mayor up there, Mike Rawlings, is the one that only gave out 5,000 tickets and had to make application to receive a ticket. So he's the one limiting the access to this memorial on the 22nd there at Dealey Plaza.
It's amazing that the political class and leaders of our country do all of these things. I don't think it's coordinated. I think there's some coordination. But there's just this locking of arms and fortress mentality to stop people from talking about these suspicious events and to stop them from investigating it. And actually, I don't think they want to shut down the 9/11 truth. I mean, they don't want that out there. But what they're really trying to do is get people who haven't heard the argument to not look at the argument. They use that term conspiracy.
Yes, exactly.
They will not read any further.
I consider you a conspiracy scholar.
And that's what we're trying to do.
A scholar in this area.
A couple of guys from Australia, Matthew Witt at the University of LeBron, Laurie Manuel in Toronto, a neurologist, a neuroscientist at a Canadian university, and a number of us have been studying these events. And it's a simple thing that we're doing. I mean, we really just name these things. So we have the state crimes against democracy, and then we get a list of them, and we categorize them and look for patterns in them. And it's amazingly simple. But if you take just a simple thing like assassinations, our tendency has been to look at those one by one. The whole idea of conspiracy suggests that it's a one-of kind of event. But what we're really talking about is serial crime or organized crime. These events happen in sequence. They occur together, so you get the 9/11 and the anthrax letter attack. You get the Kennedy assassination and Oswald and the Gulf of Tonkin. You get the 1980 October surprise and Iran-Contra. They occur in clusters, but our tendency is to look at them one by one because of the conspiracy theory label. We've really been indoctrinated on this. But once you start looking at them together, it's like, oh, well, this is obvious now. Assassinations, like, the only presidents that get killed are the ones that oppose the military. And only presidents get attacked. I mean, there's no Supreme Court justices that are attacked. There's no vice presidents that are attacked. Get this, the senators who get killed, that happens when the Senate is evenly divided, like with Paul Wellstone. I tell my students,
don't fly on a plane
with a U.S. senator when the Senate is evenly divided.
Right, exactly.
Right.
Well, there was one other aspect I sort of wanted to inject in here. We have about 7 minutes left, is that I started studying before my preparation for this interview today, and I looked at the Inquisition, I looked at the Star Chamber in England, and then I looked at FISA courts, so forth. What's happened is we can't bring charges against these people because those courts have been corrupted by the elitists that I see. What do you think?
Rights in our Constitution. Well, we tend to think of it as, well, these are rights we have. But another way to think of it is these are statements about what the government will do if you let it. It will suppress your speech. One of our rights is to have witnesses, to be confronted by the witnesses against us in trials, and to have jury trials.
And habeas corpus to be brought before and charged properly.
If we don't have that in our, if we don't guard that, that's what the government's going to do. Well, that's what the government is doing now. And there's been these, what they do is they delegate authorities to other entities, so the FISA courts, for example, where you don't get to witness the thing and keep track of it, and it's not before the U.S. Supreme Court, it's often the shadow court. I mentioned the thing about delegating the war-making power to the president. That's a lot of what goes on is creating these fake bodies, these fake governments with power.
Administrative type law bodies instead of constitutional bodies, see?
I don't know. I think there is an awakening happening in our country. And now that we're finding out about the surveillance, the mass surveillance, and the other thing that's going on is this stuff is accumulating. And when you first had the Kennedy assassination, that was one thing, and, it was like, wow, that was spooky. But then you got Bobby Kennedy and Martin Luther King and George Wallace and Ronald Reagan and the 1980 October surprise and the 68 and the Gulf of Tonkin and 9/11 and the anthrax letter attacks and Iran-Contra. You see all these things, and you start realizing, hey, there's some connections, and we've got a criminal government. We have effectively got a section or parts of our government that are organized.
Yes, we do.
Undermine democracy and
Well, Have you noticed one other thing in addition to all the big false flag operations is that NATO secret armies has gotten into America. You know that concept?
Yeah,
of shootings and yes,
thing, and, I've read that we're still in a so-called state of emergency since 9/11 that gives the president all kinds of power to do things. And these are like secret. I mean, how do you have secret laws in a democracy? I mean, there's some.
Well, the problem is that we have these secret courts, and we got them from the Inquisition by way of the Star Chamber, by the way of FISA.
Absolutely.
We've got secret courts. That is un-American, period.
The thing
that is totally evil.
That came right
out
of the Star Chamber. I mean, the American founder gets that we don't want the Star Chamber. I mean,
exactly. Oh, one thing that I did do was that a recent prime minister was using it, Gordon Brown, was using it to go after members of parliament when he was prime minister for people that were spending improperly on their expense accounts. Do you remember that? So anybody is subject to just abuse of power, right? Anyone.
When we hear about this surveillance of the American internet and email and telephone, if you think the CIA and the FBI are not eavesdropping on our elected officials, you're crazy. I mean, the CIA director was removed because he was emailing his girlfriend, and they got hold of him. I mean, so you've got intrigue and the potential for intrigue. Another thing that came out was Alito, the Supreme Court Justice, his email was being tracked. I mean, so this is not, Americans tend to think, the government knows what's best, and they're going to watch after us and all that. I mean, what we've got, I think, be an American like the founders. Realize that power corrupts. And if you give these people an inch, you'll take a yard. And that's what's happened. We trust them.
We've got about a minute and 45 seconds. What would you like to wrap it up with? What kind of final closing comments?
I think there's a tendency to throw your hands up and think, well, these scoundrels, we can't do anything about them. But the fact is we can. We can enforce the forensic requirements. Do you know when Kennedy was killed, the limousine he was in was washed at Parkland Hospital? That was the destruction of a crime scene. The people who did that should have been arrested immediately. 9/11, when the debris was cleaned up, we should have arrested the people that cleaned it up and shipped it out of the country without looking at it for explosives. We've got to demand the ordinary forensic techniques we use, and that we develop a list of suspects and interrogate them and interrogate their underlings and promise deals and find out who's behind this stuff the way we do with any other crime. And so I think there's a solution, and we've just got to, as Americans, start standing up and expecting decent law enforcement against our own leaders.
Exactly. Well, Lance DeHaven Smith, I certainly do appreciate you being with us this evening. And, thank you very much for being with us, and we want to wish you well in the future in all your studies and your writings.
Good night.
Okay, thank you very much. Good night.